is Chick Flick Fix. I'm Julia Scott.
And I'm AJ Knox.
We watch chick flicks and rom-coms and decide if they need fixing. Can we make them better or can we make them weird? And we've been making movies better and weirder for a year. It's been almost exactly pretty much 1 year, depending on when you're hearing this, of course, since the first episode came out.
It's been fun.
Yeah, but I feel also, I think we both have experienced primarily just like getting to watch something nice every week. Just like, no, if you have to choose between like prestige TV or movies or fluff, you're like, no, I have to watch. It's for the
I've got to watch the fluff. The yeah.
And to celebrate, we're talking about The Princess Bride from 1987. It's directed by Rob Reiner and written by William Goldwyn, based on his book by the same name. It stars Robin Wright, Cary Elwes, Mandy Patinkin, et al.
Yeah.
Liam Neeson revealed on an interview like 15 years ago or something that he auditioned for Fezzik. Rob Reiner scoffed when he heard that Neeson was only 6'4". There was apparently a period of time when Arnold Schwarzenegger was sort of tied to this for Fezzik, but then once it finally got made, he was too famous.
Mm, yeah.
Because this has been like in sort of development forever and ever and ever, and was like deemed unfilmable. At least, I love this, at least two studio heads lost their jobs. Parenthesis, for unrelated reasons, mere days after stating that they wish to make the film. Some people who have tried to make this include Richard Lester, Norman Jewison, Robert Redford, and Francois Truffaut.
Oh. Wow.
And Goldman, like, bought back the rights after it came back on sort of a desk clearing, like, everything gets sold out. It has, of course, been attempted to be made into a musical. No dice so far.
Good.
There really was a Dread Pirate Roberts, Bartholomew Roberts, also known as Black Bart, which is very funny, who was in the Caribbean in the early 18th century. And some people consider him the most successful pirate of all time. And before you get to tell us about the film, and before we talk a little bit about it, it's actually funny that you're going to retell it, because the book is not like the movie in that there's the frame story is not a grandpa telling the story. The frame story in the book, the story is that William Goldman is writing an annotated version of this book. Goldman's dad, in this sort of, you know, fictionalized framework, used to read him the book, and when he rereads it as an adult, he realizes that his dad took out a bunch of the, like, boring political stuff and just read the good bits. Oh. So Goldman has, in this framework, made an annotated version that is just the good bits from the story, like the adventure parts, and, like, he's tried to insert another part, but his editor didn't like it. So it's this whole, like, very sort of classic but hard to achieve version of telling a story of like, I found this in an attic or this was sent to me kind of story.
Okay.
And the story started because Goldman's daughters, one of them wanted a story about a princess, one of them wanted a story about a bride, so he started telling a story about the Princess Bride. And then as he was writing it, he got stuck somewhere, and the conceit of the annotation or the condensed version came to him. So
it's, I love that. You're like, I'm bored with writing this. I'm just going to write an abridged version of the thing I was going to write.
Yep.
I love that. That's amazing. That takes such balls. Or over them. Whatever you want.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So this, the book came out in the 70s and took forever for it to kind of, you know, 14 years from book to movie is maybe not that long. But when so many people tried and so many people, like, it went sort of to different studios, to different directors. So the one of the reasons we're watching this, it was obviously on our list, but this is a movie that you had never seen and that makes people hyperventilate when they find out that you haven't seen it.
Oh my god, I posted that I was watching it on my Instagram story, and I got so many responses. Many of them were just people commenting saying inconceivable, which I, you know, fair. But so many of them were just flabbergasted, and even like close friends were like, has our entire life been a lie? Like, what is wrong with you?
That is very funny.
And I will say, I got a handful of messages from folks who said, me neither. And
And they never dared to actually
say the thing. And it has never clicked with me until one of my friends said it. She said, yeah, I don't tell people because when I tell them, they get mad at me. I'm like, yeah, me too. And she said, instead of saying, hey, why don't we sit down and watch this movie? And I'm like, oh my God, that's all it would have taken is just somebody to say, hey, do you want to just like watch it one day? But the more people get mad at you, the more you're just like, well, then F off. I don't want to watch it.
And I think there's like an XKCD comic about that, about how when someone doesn't know something or hasn't, you know, seen or experienced something, you shouldn't go, oh my God, you know, you're the worst, how could you? Instead you go, oh my God, you get to experience this.
Yes.
For the first time, I get to share this with you, I get to show you. And I've tried really hard over, I don't know, the last 10 years to do that, because it's really easy to fall into some sort of like hipster teenager mode and be like, oh my God, how could you not? And instead you're like, I get to share this with you, or yeah, like I get to talk to you tomorrow after you've seen this. Because did you feel like you dug your heels in a little bit?
Absolutely, because it was never so, like, even first of all, the movie came out in what, 87, so I was 4. Mm-hmm. And it was called The Princess Bride, and my parents only took us to animated movies. So, you know, it was just like I would have had no cause to see it until it came out on VHS, probably. And then by the time it came out on VHS in a way that I would have been aware of it, I was probably a little boy, and I was into X-Men and scary movies and stuff, and I didn't want to watch a movie about a princess or a bride. So I would have had no interest in it, and then...
So you were basically Fred Savage.
Yeah. No, as soon as he's like, is this a kissing book? I was like, movie, are you a kissing movie?
But maybe you're a little bit more tolerant of kissing movies now.
Now, yes. But yeah, I don't think I dug my heels in, but like, this was not, as I recall, like, we went to high school together, and I recall, like, the high school fondness for, like, 80s, early 90s kind of fantasy seemed to float more towards The Labyrinth, The Willows, the, mm-hmm. like, this was not in that. So I remember, like, hanging out with thespians watching Labyrinth, and I remember hanging out with thespians watching Willow and, like, weird stuff like that. But, not this. This didn't come up. I don't even think, like, this movie re-entered my, like, radar until college.
I actually didn't see this as a kid because it wasn't a phenomenon in Sweden in the same way, I don't think. So I didn't see it as a kid or as a teenager. And like you said, I don't think it came up, like, really in high school. So I saw it in my early 20s. And it was hilarious when I told Pontus that you hadn't seen it before we were talking about it, because I rewatched it. And he was like, what? I was like, you hadn't seen it until not that long ago. He's like, well, I saw it maybe like, you know, 10 years ago with you. And I was like, you don't get to claim this. But I think maybe the sort of 80s, 90s fantasy thing is that because this is like earnest and goofy,
yes,
in a way that Labyrinth isn't. Like, Labyrinth has its goofiness, but it's a very sort of winky, artsy goofiness.
Yes.
Whereas this is just like, no pants, jump on a horse. Like, it's very silly.
And there's a good bit of slapstick in it, too.
Yeah, it is. Like, it kind of does verge on, you know, Mel Brooks. So, like, it's not just that Cary Elwes is in both this and Men in Tights. Like, it has, yeah, that same sort of buffoonery. I think mostly in a good way, but I could see how, like, you know, kind of cool theater kids would be like, no, Labyrinth. We're watching Labyrinth.
Right.
Or something like that.
And it's the one with David Bowie. It's the one with the gender fluid lead. So we're going to watch that. but yeah, but also to that point, I think that even little things like Inigo Montoya is a Spaniard and he has a Spanish accent. But what's his name is...
Vizzini. Sicilian and Vizzini has no...
is a Sicilian, and he's just Wallace Shawn.
And also, he doesn't have the fantasy English accent that almost, right, everyone else does.
Yeah.
Because I think it's Wallace Shawn and Billy Crystal are the only people with no English accent.
Yeah, the Jewish, the very Jewish magicians. It reminded me a little bit of... the theater I work at did Oklahoma a number of years back, and Ali Hakim is a very problematic character in that play. If you remember Oklahoma, he's a very bad Eastern stereotype, kind of swindler. And the way that my theater did it is they had a white guy in the role, but he was a grifter from New York.
Nice.
And so he was coming
in. Or nicer, at least.
I mean, it was a way to just kind of take that stereotype and kind of put it on a character who was using it to in a negative way. He wasn't doing brownface or anything, but he was just you don't know what my accent is, and I'm from Mali Hakim. And that's just how he played it, as just this con artist who is grifting these poor Oklahomans. And I was like, okay, that's a very smart way to handle problematic stuff.
Okay, what? Go through the good bits and tell us what this movie is about.
This is a special book. It was the book my father used to read to me when I was sick, and I used to read it to your father. And today I'm going to read it to you.
I'll try and stay awake.
Wesley had no money for marriage, so he packed his few belongings and left the farm to seek his fortune across the sea. The war of the land gave Humperdinck the right to choose his bride.
The fabric will make the prince suspect the Gildarians have abducted his love.
I never say anything about killing anyone.
I just happened to look behind us and something is there.
He's obviously seen us with the princess and let's therefore die. Pick up one of those rocks. Get behind the boulder. The minute his head is in view, hit it with the rock!
I was not a sportsman there.
All right, so Princess Bride, and here's my thing. Please don't write in and tell me all the things I got wrong because you have the movie memorized, as so many of you do. I've seen it once, so please bear with me. So Fred Savage is a kid in 1987. He's playing some baseball video games. He's homesick. I don't believe he's really sick. I think he's just having a Ferris Bueller's day off, ready to go out and party, and then his grandfather shows up. It's like, God damn it, I was gonna go paint the town red. Now I gotta sit here with my granddad. So grandpa comes and he says, I'm gonna read you this book. It's called The Princess Bride. And he's like, okay, fine, grandpa. Grandpa starts reading. It's about a woman named Buttercup and her farm boy. Is that what he is? He's a farm boy or something? Named Wesley. And I will say also, grandpa arrives straight out of Central Casting.
He, like Peter Falk, you're like, all right, Columbo, there are better ways to make hair look gray and white. It looks like if I spray dry shampoo in my hair to look old.
I love it because it's just so, and he's just such a, I don't know. I want to know what he did, what research he did to get into this role, because he is such a caricature, but I love it. So yeah, so he shows up to read this story called The Princess Bride, and it starts off about Buttercup and her farm boy, and she loves the farm boy because he does whatever she wants when she asks him
which
to.
Which is a very interesting.
Right, this is like a bad power dynamic, and all he says is "as you wish," which will come into play later. So they realize that slowly over time, Buttercup realizes that every time he says "as you wish," he's saying "I love you," and she realizes that she loves the farm boy. And then they smooch, and Fred Savage asks, "Wait a minute, is this a kissing book? I don't want this to be a kissing book." And Grandpa's just like, "Give it a minute." So then Wesley has to go off on an overseas adventure. And news comes back promptly that he has been killed by the Dread Pirate Roberts. Or no, his ship has been attacked by the Dread Pirate Roberts, who leaves no survivors. So they don't get any confirmation of his death, but it is assumed that he is dead. 5 years later, Princess Buttercup is all set to marry Prince Humperdinck. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, and I love how so much of it is like, you know, a dad just grasping for silly names to make his kid laugh.
Right. So Buttercup is now set to become Princess Buttercup by marrying Prince Humperdinck. But yes, she is a commoner. And on the wedding day, she is... Or is it the wedding day?
No, it's the engagement day.
The engagement
day. She gets kidnapped.
She gets kidnapped by three ruffians, Andre the Giant's Fezzik, Wallace Shawn's Vizzini, and Mandy Patinkin's Inigo Montoya. And they set sail upon a boat.
Because this is also the thing about this movie. Like, I'm assuming that there were kind of like with other movies that we've touched on before, we were like, oh, that's what, now I get, oh, that, like, that is this quote, that, yes, is this gif, that is this reference.
Yes, the inconceivable, like, and here's the thing I will say. I have seen so much of this movie in drips and drabs, just walking into a room, mm-hmm, as somebody's watching it, or through people quoting it, that very little of this movie felt new, which was a little weird. It was kind of a weird way to absorb it. But
I mean, also, because this movie is a sort of vignette-y story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Because it is the best parts.
Yeah, and it moves quick. To that point, she gets kidnapped because Vizzini wants to start a war between the two rival kingdoms. So he's going to leave her body on one side of the kingdom or something and start a war. It's a very, very brushed over plot. And they they head out on a ship through
it kind of makes me think of, you know, Wag the Dog or anything where you're like,
yeah,
if we can just do a look over there.
Exactly.
We can control the populace.
Yeah, he's got big. This is Vizzini is a poor man's Littlefinger. They kidnap the princess as they're escaping in their toy boat. I love this boat.
Hang on a second. I need to check when the first Game of Thrones book came out, because this movie does have a lot of like sort of crossover.
It does have a lot. I was watching it saying there are a surprising amount of Game of Thronesy.
Yeah, he started writing the series in 91, so both the book and this movie were out. Oh. I mean, I'm all for just, you know, sort of crossbreeding in fantasy, but there's a lot of fun stuff
there. Yeah, so I think confirmed Game of Thrones is a plagiarized version of Princess Bride. Have we confirmed this?
Confirmed, stamped, and copied, yes.
Great. So then Vizzini walks into a fire with three dragon eggs, and then they all birth on him. I don't know. No, so they're running away. They're being chased by a boat, and the boat has the Dread Pirate Roberts on it, who is Wesley with a mask on and a mustache. And so the Dread Pirate Roberts / Wesley...
When he says masks are terribly comfortable, I think everyone will be wearing them in the future.
Yeah.
Like, you know, several billion people went, oof.
Yeah, exactly. I was watching that and I was, oh no.
And it starts with a little boy who's coughing.
Oh my God. This.
Continue.
All right. Let's keep an eye out for these things. So Princess Buttercup jumps in the water to escape, but there are horrible flesh-eating eels in the water.
They're shrieking eels.
Shrieking eels. The shrieking eels are in the water, and they have to drag her out of the water. They end up going to the cliffs of impending peril. Cliffs of unfathomable... I'm just going to start making up names because I know everyone's screaming into their headphones right now. They get to the cliffs of unrecognizable uncertainty. And
Cliffs of Insanity is
Cliffs of Insanity.
Yes, and I love that things are named like this. Like, yeah. This is it's high fantasy in both meanings of the word high.
Yes, exactly. So they get to the Cliffs of Insanity. There's conveniently a rope for them to climb. Fezzik puts everyone on his back and they start climbing up the rope. The Dread Pirate Roberts starts climbing up the rope after them. When they get to the top, they leave Inigo Montoya to fight him off because Inigo Montoya is a skilled swordsman. And he says, I'll do it with my left hand. Make it sporting.
No. He says, it's over so quickly when I use my right hand.
Yeah.
So I'll use... And you're just like...
Oh, I didn't even... Okay. Good masturbation joke, Princess Bride. They cut the rope, but the Dread Pirate Roberts is still climbing up the wall. He gets up. They have a really great sword fight.
No stunt doubles. They
really?
Did it, the whole thing themselves. Yeah,
that's great.
They trained for, you know, months and months with really good fencing teachers.
On this great set that has all these levels that they can play around on. It's beautifully lit.
And they all look very much like styrofoam.
Yes. That's kind of what I love about this movie is everything does look like a set. I mean, their boat looks like a set. They're a prop even. the sword fight area looks like it. So much of it looks like set. And I like that. I don't know if that's intentional or if that's just us seeing through. Like, there's a point where he flips over him and he lands and it's clearly a pad covered in dirt. Like, the edges of the pad bounce up.
But also, like, they do, you know, gymnastic tricks onto that on this perfectly level bar. Like, yeah, it is very self-aware and it's like, it's corny and in a way that you have to leave your pretentious teens to appreciate more, I think.
They have this great sword fight up at, you know, sunset or sunrise. I think it's dawn because then he keeps falling through the day. And Prince Humperdinck also shows up to the scene shortly after the Dread Pirate Roberts bests Inigo Montoya. And he's like, oh, so Prince Humperdinck is on the trail. And we find out, I don't know if it's here that we find out, but we find out that he sent Fezzik and Vizzini and Inigo Montoya to kidnap the Buttercup and start a war. So this is all a political intrigue from the top down.
Goes all the way to the top.
Dread Pirates Roberts beats Inigo Montoya, follows them. He gets in a fight with Fezzik, who is a giant, and he beats him kind of accidentally, clumsily. And there's some really good physical comedy in that bit, too. And then, of course, he catches up to Vizzini, who is having a little picnic. And then we get the iconic poison in the cup scene, you know, switching both of the glasses. And he says, well, the whole, you know, so I clearly can't trust the glass in front of me bit, the over-logicking himself, and then ends with a look over there and a glass switch, which is funny because it doesn't matter which glass he takes, even if he doesn't do the look over there, because
they're both poisoned.
Well, they're both poisoned, but the Dread Pirates Robert/Wesley is giving him the choice anyway, so he could just pick one.
Well, I think his thing with switching them is he wants to see the satisfaction in the pirate's face and then go, aha!
Yes.
Which he actually does.
But then he falls over as he's classic blunders. Never start a land war in Asia. And
never go up against a Sicilian when death is on the line.
Death is on the line. I can't do a good Wallace Shawn impression. So then he has a great laugh. And again, this is where some of that wonderful comedy comes in. He's laughing, and then just stops and tips over.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's great. So Dread Pirate Roberts tells Buttercup that he's been spending years developing an immunity or tolerance for iocane powder, and then reveals himself to actually be Wesley by yelling, as you wish, as he rolls down a hill.
And she rolls after him, and again, such a funny scene. Like, why is that the most effective way for you to go after him?
To go down the hill.
And just amazing stunt tumbling down this hill.
Yeah. I could see, okay, so here's one point where I am like, this would be so much better. It would be so much better in the book because you wouldn't visually see that it is Cary Elwes.
Mm-hmm.
So the book could have this big grand reveal and have it feel like a big grand reveal. The movie, it's a known quantity. That's like my one little knock about that. I wish he had like a big bushy beard or is in some way even more unrecognizable so that you actually didn't know as a viewer. So anyway, they roll down the hill. So this is the other thing I forgot to mention. So Inigo Montoya is trying to find a six-fingered man who murdered his father, which I'm sure everybody already knows. I think everyone who is listening to this has seen this movie probably at least seven times. They roll down the hill. He yells, as you wish. She realizes that it's Wesley, the farm boy that she loves. She throws herself after him. And as they're walking through this bog of doom, I don't know what any of the places are called, Through the Bog of Doom, he's telling her that that it's the Fire Swamp, right? Isn't that what it is?
Yeah.
He's telling her that the Dread Pirate Roberts is just really a name. It's like Batman.
More of a franchise.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this is just Batman. You get it. It's strike fury to the hearts of men, and it's more about the symbol than the actual person. So he says now that he's found her, he's going to give up the title. They're in the Fire Swamp. There's fire everywhere. They fall into a pit of quicksand, which I'm like, this movie is just doing, there's fire pits, there's quicksand, there's pirates. They fall in, they pull themselves out with a vine, and then they get attacked by a rodent of unusual size, which is clearly just a person running around on all fours in a mouse costume. So they get out of the Fire Swamp. Wesley's been hurt a little bit. Humperdinck is waiting for them because he's been following them. Buttercup says, okay, I'll come back with you, but you have to release Wesley. And then he's like, sure, of course, I'll do whatever you want. You're my bride to be. And he says, as Buttercup is going with him, he says to his vizier, who is Christopher Guest, I love it when Christopher Guest plays characters that just are not funny. Like, the vizier doesn't have a lot of great jokes, but he's just evil. And I kind of love that. Prince Humperdinck is like, hey, Christopher Guest, why don't you go ahead and take Wesley to your torture chamber, which is the pit of madness, the pit of horrifying
despair.
Thoughts. Pit of despair. Pit of despair.
I kind of want to let you name these things.
This is kind of like me reading the book out loud, just making it up. So Count Rugen is all ready to do that, and Wesley sees that he has six fingers on his hand. So Count Rugen, we now know, is the true killer of Inigo Montoya's father. Humperdinck then also tells Buttercup he's going to look for the Dread Pirate, or Wesley, not the Dread Pirate Roberts, but yes, because she loves him, and he says, well, I don't want you to marry me if you don't truly love me. I'm going to send out one ship in each direction till they find him, and then he'll come back for you. Of course he doesn't do that because he's a liar. He's going to have her killed, and he's going to frame the other country for doing it so that they can start a war. That he gets this group of, like, raiders. We'll call them the ruffians. I don't know. Oh, wait, no, I'm jumping past the initial torture with the albino, or the initial cleaning. So Wesley gets taken into the pit of horrible things, and an albino is there.
The pit of mild discomfort.
The pit of mild discomfort. An albino guy is there, and he is kind of getting him ready. He's like, oh, you'll never get out of here. It's spooky in here. Bad stuff's going to happen. So Prince Humperdinck says,
you know, hey, what this is? Have you seen that video of Star Wars as explained by a 3-year-old?
This is how I feel right now, because I am so intimidated by this movie.
Because the 3-year-old is like, don't talk back to Darth Vader. He'll get you.
He'll get you.
But part of the story is also kind of as if it was made up by a 5-year-old. So I'm all for it. Keep going.
So yeah, Humperdinck sends his bands of hooligans and thieves out to, you know,
they're the brute force, which is such a good name for for a special task force.
Yeah, that does sound very much like a Mel Brooks, joke from a Mel Brooks movie. So Fezzik is part of this group of ruffians and ne'er-do-wells. And he comes across Inigo Montoya, who is drinking himself into a stupor after having lost to Wesley, the Dread Pirate Roberts. And they reunite and they realize, hey, we were really good guys all along. And they set off to how does he convince him to set off? What does he convince him to do? He says,
Fezzik tells him about the Count, but I'm not sure. I don't remember how Fezzik finds out.
Yeah, about the Count. I don't remember how Fezzik finds out.
But he's like,
either.
Well, maybe Rugen, when he enlisted Fezzik, sees his hand.
So basically they decide that they need to find Wesley. Oh, the other thing that happens right before Fezzik finds Inigo Montoya is is that when they do the initial life drain on Wesley?
Yeah.
And he screams in agony. Maybe that's how they know. They just hear him scream. Somebody write in, tweet at us right now before the end of this episode. We'll get to it.
No, I think that Fezzik is like, hey, we have to whatnot, and then they're going to go storm the castle. Because they need Wesley to make up the thing. Because they say something about how he bested Inigo by steel, he bested Fezzik by strength, and he bested Vizini by brain. So obviously they need him to be their new head honcho.
Yeah. Okay. That's right. Yeah. So they follow the sounds of his wailing through the forest as he's being tortured. They find him, and he's dead, mostly dead. And they take him to Miracle Max, who is Billy Crystal. And
who apparently brought in a picture of his grandma to the makeup artist.
Shut up. I love it. And yeah, so he's basically this kind of miracle worker, and he starts reviving Wesley along, and Carol Kane pops in and as his wife. I mean, they're in it for like 5 total minutes, but it's so great. And we have the issue now that as Wesley is being rejuvenated, he's barely able to move. So he's just very slowly regaining movement in parts of his body, which leads to
I figure it like sort of life meters in video games.
Yeah.
Where like between mostly dead and actually alive and spry, you have to sort of slowly go up through red and orange,
yeah, yellow, and green. He's working on it. So Wesley and Fezzik and Inigo Montoya go to the castle, and Humperdinck's like, uh-oh, we got to do a wedding, and we got to make a wedding happen quick. And they're chasing Inigo Montoya starts chasing Rugen through the castle, and because Rugen's being a little bratty brat and kind of teasing him about his dad. That's the other thing I was thinking of, is as he was chasing him, it was really physical. It's like, oh, this movie has a kind of insane amount of physicality, particularly for Inigo Montoya.
Yeah, it is, because they wanted that sort of Errol Flynn-y early, yeah. Like, there is a lot of stuff here, like, swinging it, from things.
And it totally has that, like, old school adventure feel to it. Meanwhile, this wedding is being hustled along with the marriage minister. Fezzik is kind of using Wesley as a weapon as he's mowing his way through the castle. Inigo Montoya gets to Count Rugen. Count Rugen throws a throwing knife in his gut, and then he stabs him really slowly in each shoulder and painful looking. Like, it hurt me to watch that, and I thought, mm-hmm. Wow, this is really intense for a kid's movie, because he does just slide the blade into his shoulders slowly. But, of course, Inigo Montoya regains the strength to say, hi, I'm Inigo, and my dad is dead because of you, so I'm going to kill you. So that's what he keeps saying over and over again, verbatim, exact words. I will say, his character is the most grounded of all, I think, of all the characters in the whole movie. And I think there's a reason why people latch on to his character so much. It's mm-hmm. not just because he's suave and charming, which he is, but I think he's so believable. And he's so, he tugs at your heartstrings throughout the whole movie. He's also one of the, well, we'll get into it, but he's like one of the only characters with a really full arc in my mind. Anyway, so, Prince Humper, so he ends up killing Count Rugen, and then we cut into Princess Buttercup's chamber, and Wesley's there laying in her bed. He looks pretty run down, and he's definitely not at the top of his game, but then Prince Humperdinck comes in, and Wesley stands up, and he's like, hey, you give me back that princess, and he points his sword at him. And he says, you give me that back, that princess, or I'm gonna stab you with my swordy sword. And Prince Humperdinck is like, oh wow, you're scary, you're intimidating. Okay, I'm gonna sit down and let the princess tie me up. And as soon as he gets tied up, Wesley collapses because he just mustered the tiny little bit of strength he had to put on this show of bravado. Very Dread Pirate Roberts. It's all about show.
And the prince goes, I knew you were bluffing. I don't know why that's so funny, because he says it to, I don't remember if it's Fezzik or Buttercup who's behind him, and he like turns Buttercup around. He's like, I knew he was bluffing.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that's so funny. That's one of those tiny things where you're like,
and Inigo Montoya shows up, and he's a little worse for wear, but he's alive. Fezzik is downstairs with a bunch of horses, and they jump out the window, and Fezzik catches Buttercup. They ride off into the sunset, and then, of course, Princess Buttercup and Wesley share a kiss, and we realize Fred Savage. We are back in Fred Savage's room, and we realize that he is really invested in this whole thing. And
Grandpa, well, I mean, we've been realizing that off and on with him going, wait, no, he can't be dead.
Yeah, he can't be dead. When they kill Wesley, he can't be dead. So he's getting more and more invested. But this is when he's like, this is when he's interested in the romance.
Grandpa, I don't mind it so much.
Grandpa goes to leave. It is now nighttime, and I'm thinking, so has this child been in bed all day without a meal, without a snack? This is poor babysitting.
Well, he had a snack from the beginning. He was halfway through. You see him eating like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
I guess that's true. And Grandpa, or as Grandpa's leaving, Fred Savage is like, hey, maybe Grandpa, do you want to come back tomorrow and read me this book? And Grandpa says, in the last line of the movie, iconically bringing it all back, he says, of course I will. no, he says, as you wish, of course. And so As You Wish closes the movie, and that's The Princess Bride, which I have now officially seen.
Awesome.
Ta-da.
Ta-da. Yeah. I've just been thinking about all the parallels. Like, in the beginning, like, The Princess Bride is basically Sansa from Game of Thrones.
Okay,
she's like, starts out super haughty and very like, and then slowly she's like married off to people she doesn't want to be married off to. And
Okay, wait. Vizini is Ferris. Wait, what's that? Is that Varys? Varys, the eunuch. Yeah. Because he's a little bit more of a schemer, and he's a little bit more like, I'm cool and collected. But Littlefinger, I think, is Christopher Guest.
Sixfinger?
Yeah. Because he's really the evil one.
He's extra finger.
Yeah.
So do you, because, you know, we have this main love story here, and they're so fairy tale that you don't really care about them that much.
Yeah.
Like, I care about Wesley as he's going through the story, because he is very swashbuckling.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes, I know what the happy ending has to be, but really it is all the sort of side characters.
Yeah. They're both so pretty and plain. There's just like, that's what they are. And they're really, as you said, they're really just vehicles to get us from one misadventure to the other with all these great side characters and villains.
But I love that Cary Elwes gets to hear say lines like, well, I'm not left-handed either. And then later gets to say, because unlike previous Robin Hoods, I can speak with an English accent. he just gets to be this sort of snooty but approachable. Yeah.
Yeah.
But really, really, it's the side characters, right?
Absolutely. This movie is all about the side characters. I feel like there's a valiant effort with the As You Wish as a recurring theme to make this a grand love story, a fated love story. They do have chemistry, I will say that.
Do you have a favorite side character?
I mean, It is a toss. I'm going to pick a favorite hero and a favorite villain. My favorite hero is Mandy Patinkin, Inigo Montoya.
Who starts off as a villain.
Right. He does start off as a villain. But
he's a rapier for hire.
And like I said, I feel like he is kind of the only character in this movie with a really true character arc. You know, and growth, he changes, he grows. You could say that a little bit for Fezzik as well, but it's really him. He has a duty to fulfill. He fulfills that duty at risk of his own life. He sacrifices himself for this cause. You know, there's so much to like about him as a character, on top of him, just as I mentioned, being charming and fun and swashbuckling. But my favorite villain is Vizini. And so he died, and I turned to Jenna, who was, I think she wasn't even watching. She was working. I was watching it in the middle of the day with Lincoln. And he dies. I turn, we're 30 minutes into the movie. We're already here. And that was the one surprising thing, was how quickly everything moves in this movie.
Because it skips over all of the sort of transport bits that so much fantasy has. And again, yeah. in the book within the book, there's supposedly all this like political history that's super boring, and that's part of what they take out. But also, you know, you take out all of the like, hey, walkie, walkie, walkie. Oh no, a giant spider, walkie, walkie, walkie. Oh look, here's
so this is where this is where Game of Thrones got their idea for the last two seasons, because everyone is moving around this giant world instantly, basically. Oh yeah. What about you? Favorite characters?
I don't know, like, because they're like favorites in different ways,
right?
Like, I like Miracle Max.
I was going to say Miracle Max is up there too.
He's so stupid. He's so silly. He's so like not out of place, because Jews have existed in Europe for a long time. They just probably didn't sound like, you know, 1950s New Yorkers. and I love, you know, I love Inigo Montoya. I like Fezzik because he's just sort of bumbling along, and you get the feeling that, because like
he's kind-hearted,
but he's been sort of, you know, exploited in circuses and as brute force his whole life. I don't know, I just it's just so many silly funny characters. Really, there aren't that many though. Like, it feels like there's this huge gallery, but there isn't. It's just that things happen so quickly,
and we jump around so fast, right? Like, it's so and as you mentioned, it's vignettes. It's this scene, and then this, you know, you could pull out any scene. And I think maybe that's why the movie didn't feel terribly surprising, is because I have seen so many of these scenes just randomly out of order.
Or they've been referred to.
And when people start to refer to a scene in this movie, they usually capture its essence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the marriage is what brings us together today. You know, the jokes keep going with that speech impediment, but that's the joke.
Do you have a favorite part?
Oh, that's a good question. Okay. I think my favorite part is the cup swapping.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do love Vizzini. I think he's great. But my actual favorite element of the movie, which I can appreciate now, is that it is a movie that is modeling a path to empathy and softness for boys. Do you know what I mean? Like, it is Fred Savage is initially, like many,
he just wants the torture bits,
little boys. Yeah, he's just, I don't want a kissing book. But by the end of it, he has come to appreciate the importance of love and empathy and kindness. And, you know, those softer elements of the book become the things that are most important to him. The emotional thing. And I do think that we still struggle with.
I think that's really nice. I don't think I've thought about it that way. And that may be because I used to be a little girl.
Right.
Who read books like this.
But we still struggle with that.
I always thought as just a sort of like small comedic detail where he's like, I don't mind it so much now.
Yeah. And it is funny. Like, it's cute and funny. But I do think it is kind of and I think about the men who I know who really like this movie, and they are good men. You know, they are not I do know several men, not friends necessarily, but several men who are pretty toxic in their masculinity. And I can't imagine them liking this movie.
That is really interesting. That's a good filter. Maybe people should start using that on dating apps.
Yeah.
I think my favorite part is that so ridiculous, you know, Jack and Jill came tumbling after down there.
Yeah,
She just like jumps, makes a full like leap, and then tumbles, and there's all this oofing and sound effects, and it's because it's so ridiculous.
It is very goofy, and I do it feels like they slant the camera too to make the hill look even steeper.
Yeah, probably. How do you feel about the end? Do you feel that it's satisfying? I wish that Fezzik had like a draft horse. Because I feel like his feet would be reaching the ground around.
I know.
That
I feel bad for whatever horse he's going to get on. Yeah, I like the ending. It does have a bit of an anti. After Inigo Montoya kills Count Rugen, it does kind of Peter, like, run out of steam a little bit. That there's that last confrontation with Wesley. And I know it's supposed to be just a threat and then a collapse. But I mean, that's such a tiny little knock against it in my book. It's I do like that the film doesn't necessarily kind of introduce a love triangle with Inigo Montoya, because you feel like it could easily have tried that.
Although it would have been really funny if she met him and she was like, oh, because like, oh, she hasn't really met any men. She's spent all this time talking about her true love, and then she's like, hey.
Yeah. And I do. And so, yeah, I mean, the kiss at the end, it's iconic, and I like there's a sweetness too, of particularly now that I have a kid, watching her interact with my parents, and I'm like, oh, I can't wait for them to read her stories, and I want her to want them to come back and read her more stories, you know. So there's a little soft spot for me in that, but yeah, you know, it's a sweet ending, and it is. Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's the other thing too, is the grandfather says to the grandson the thing that means I love you at the end. So it's not just as you wish. It's saying
that's very true. Love. That's very sweet.
Yeah.
The only thing that, like, just from my experience, I'm like, except most like fantasy storybooks like this would end on more of a cliffhanger.
Yes.
But maybe like we can imagine this as being like the whole story is 7 or 8 books, even though it's not.
Yeah.
So this is, on Rotten Tomatoes, this has a 97% fresh rating from critics, a 94% fresh rating from audiences, and it has an 8.0 on IMDb.
I mean, that's got to be the highest.
I don't think we've gotten that far above a 7, like maybe like a 7.2. But yeah, so I think this is like a universally beloved movie. What would you give this out of 10 buttercups?
So I do not have the nostalgia lens that I do feel that this movie benefits from.
But on the other hand, you do have the lens of, oh, that's what that is.
Yeah. I recognize its significance. I really liked it. And I know I'm going to get, people will be angry about this, but I'm going to give it a 9, not a 10. I really, really liked it. I feel like I do honestly think the point I'm docking is less about the movie and more about the fandom. Because there is a toxicity to the fandom around this, where if you don't like it, you are wrong. And that I don't appreciate that about the way some folks approach movies. So I'm docking the point more for the way the film has become embedded in our cultural legacy, and less about the film itself, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
I give it an 8.
Oh.
Because, like, it is a really good movie. And also, like you said, like, I see its sort of cultural, contextual significance. But, and, you know, I like it. It makes me happy. It's fun. It has lots of fun elements. But it is not at the level of, like, magnificence as other movies that I have given a 9 or would give a 9.
Mm-hmm.
In no way does that make it a bad movie. It's like an 8 is only a bad grade when you have the sort of rabid fans that you talked about.
Yeah.
You know, like an 8 would make some people be like, well, that's a surprisingly low score for this movie.
Right.
But it's a solid 8.
I think that works.
So we've talked a little bit about it. Does this movie need fixing? Can it be fixed? Because my thing is basically, like, the way I think this movie could be made better is to make it weirder.
Yeah.
Like, I want more of the silly names and the, like, stupid jokes and, like, all these things. And I want even more sort of truncated travel. Like, they're just like, you know, they talk about how far it is to the castle, and then they're like, and 15 minutes later, they're there. And they look super fresh. Like, just turn that up even more.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, so that it feels even more like there's this whole, like, you know, long, like, 4 chapters of them going through the mountains and talking about how politics has changed the market for cheese. And, you know, like, all this stupid stuff. And that gets taken out. So it's weird. Like, suddenly everyone has longer beards. But it's only been a day. Like, just do that more, because also, like, the names, they're so fun, they're so silly, they're so high fantasy but with a wink. So, like, right. I think I would want more of that.
Yeah. I would absolutely agree. I think that I would love a couple elements to be put into this. And to me, I totally agree. I think that leaning into the I am telling you an abridged version of a story quality of it, so that playing around with the actual elements of film, so mm-hmm. editing, you know, almost breaking the fourth wall a little bit. But I think of things like Buster Keaton had these in some of his earlier films before his films got more narrative driven. He would do what they called impossible jokes. Like, he would paint a hook on the wall and then hang his hat on that hook and it would mm-hmm. stay.
Yeah.
Or he would, an elevator would be taking too long, so he'd reach up and move the arrow over the elevator in those old timey elevators, and then the door would open.
Or like, or exaggerate the set feeling,
right? Exactly.
Of parts of it where it's like, the, you know, the story is the important part here, and maybe the writer didn't care enough to, or the person who's retelling it is like, I don't care about all these adjectives and all these descriptions, so right. I'm just gonna sort of blur it out around the edges. Yeah
So adding some of those, you know, cuts for time or edits, or, you know, to feel like we're moving the story along in a way that is kind of artificial, but making jokes out of that. The other thing I was thinking mm-hmm. too, is in terms of the way it's being told, I would love some drunk history kind of stuff in here, of, you know, having the characters mouthing
lip-sync
along
what the yeah
to what Fred Savage and the grandpa are saying. And, you know, and maybe that just involves, like, more interaction between Fred Savage and the grandpa in terms of, so wait, he said this, and then then the grandpa kind of summarizing the next scene along with Fred Savage, and then having the characters act it out.
Yeah.
Stuff like, just little goofy bits like that to lean into the storytelling. But now that you've said it too, I think that is also probably just the make it weird as well. It's...
Well, my make it weird was also a little bit... because we were talking about, like, Labyrinth, and how that is a movie that, you know, in a lot of ways takes itself more seriously and the people watch in a different way. But that's the one with Muppets in it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, where are the Muppets here? Oh, the closest you get are the rodents of unusual size. And this movie would be even better with Muppets in it.
Yes,
I know they're not Muppets. They're studio creatures, whatever, but they're Muppets.
Oh my god, like, wait.
Here is where you have the orange creatures juggling their own heads, right?
Yeah. Okay, I want to do this really quick, because this is one of my favorite projects to do with Shakespeare plays, is recast as Muppets. Princess Buttercup, clearly Miss Piggy, or Janice.
I think Janice.
Janice.
And Miss Piggy is just, like, consistently extremely offended that she's not Buttercup.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Wesley.
Is Gonzo.
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. Wesley is Gonzo.
And Kermit is Vizzini.
Hey, old Kermit the Frog here. Never trust a Spaniard, or never trust a Sicilian when death is on the line. Yeah, that works. Fezzik is Fozzie Bear.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. Fezzik would have to be, Sweetums. The big Muppet with the big mouth. Mm-hmm. So then Inigo Montoya, I think would have to be Rolf. Rolf to me is like the Muppet who has the deepest soul. This is good. Who is Prince Humperdinck? Sam the Eagle? Or is that count?
For some reason, I just want Beaker and what's his face to be Rugen and,
Bunsen and Beaker?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
It's a really weird casting. Or it could be Waldorf and...
Statler and Waldorf? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. I like that. I would say Bunsen and Beaker, just so you could get Beaker as Count Rugen when he's explaining the machine, to just be going...
Yes!
The whole time. this is great.
Who is Miracle Max? Miracle Max and his wife are obviously Statler and Waldorf.
Yes. Absolutely, Miracle Max. There's Statler and Waldorf. Who are we missing? Wait, let me go to IMDb.
Well, the grandpa.
The
is
grandpa,
it the grandpa Sam the Eagle?
Yeah, I could see the grandpa being Sam the
no,
Eagle.
No. Miss Piggy has been made to play the grandpa with also like a pretty bad wig and mustache.
Yes, and
she's so
just,
offended about it.
And she's karate chopping bits out of the story to get through it faster. I'm going to take this out. Hiya!
And animal is Fred Savage.
So, instead of on the kissing part, he's just, woman, woman. Oh my gosh, we're missing a couple. Like, we're missing the albino, but I think we got
maybe
there.
Actually, now I'm thinking about who would be the preacher who talks about marriage.
Oh, that would be Sam the Eagle.
Yes.
Or no, the preacher would be Fozzie, because we haven't gotten Fozzie in there yet now.
Oh, yeah, no, that's true.
Because instead of doing marriage, he would do marriage jokes.
And the Swedish chef is the king.
Oh, I was going to say the Swedish chef is the albino. As he's like cleaning up his wound
okay,
with his
yes,
human hands.
Yes, oh, I'll allow that because I was thinking the king who's just very much like, she kissed me.
Oh, that is good. Yeah. That I think the king can be Sam the Eagle because he's like regal, but then to make Sam the Eagle be kind of goofy would be kind of fun.
All right.
That was amazing. Thank you for indulging me on that.
Oh, absolutely. If the listeners don't know, there is also actually a Muppet Show on the, I was about to say the Inconceivable Network, it's the Incomparable Network, which is called Bear Left, Right Frog, where Quinn Rose and Stephen Hackett talk about Muppet stuff. So maybe we should have them on this show and recast something.
Oh my gosh, yes. It is literally my favorite thing to do with Shakespeare plays, because then you boil these characters down to their quintessence.
Yeah, so Bear Left, Right Frog on The Incomparable. Highly recommend. Did we learn anything from this movie? Do you think you'll watch it again?
Oh, yeah, I think I'll watch it again. Yeah. Now that I'm past that point, and I'm now excited to not be mauled by rabid fans every time I tell them I haven't seen this movie.
and now if someone asks you, so what do you think? You'll be like, here's a link.
Here are my thoughts. Here's the podcast.
I don't want to talk about this again. I learned that it was really fun to recast it as Muppets.
Yeah.
Next week, we will be starting off our musical May with Muriel's Wedding. You can find our show notes, including links to Muppet podcasts and other stuff that we've talked about at theincomparable.com/chickflickfix. We're chickflickfix on Twitter and Instagram. You can give us a ping there. If you're so inclined, please give us a review and some stars where you do that kind of thing, because algorithm, blah, blah, blah. We'll be back next week. Say goodbye, AJ.
Goodbye, AJ.